Well, good morning. Thanks for coming to Genesis. If you're a guest with us, my name is Mike. I am one of the elders here and the preaching pastor, and it's a privilege to stand up here for a few minutes to get to share from the scriptures with you. We hope that you will meet God and encounter his presence this morning and be challenged by what he has to say to you. I was thinking about this. I just gave you a creative name that says I'm the lead pastor of this church, and I like being a pastor. I really like the idea that God has called me to hang out with people and to stand up in front of you and to study the scriptures and do all that kind of stuff. But sometimes the title pastor kind of weirds me out. Not really because of the title, but because of some of the people who have been pastors that I've known, and sometimes there is a little bit of a weirdness that goes with being a pastor. Some people were talking to my wife recently, and they said, you know, your husband doesn't really act like a pastor. And I'm not sure whether to take that as a compliment or not. That's a good thing. Maybe it's a weird thing. My son replied by, yeah, he's a little more like a game show host. So I was like, wow, that's touching and moving. But, you know, I was thinking about titles, and I actually got this email from a guy that had this thing. It was talking about, you know, creative names for pastors. He was actually making fun. I don't mind being called a pastor. I just know that sometimes the idea of pastor, it's either one of two groups of people sometimes. It's guys who are really Poindexters. Like, you know, they wear dress socks with white tennis shoes pulled up to their knees and really tight shorts and tight t-shirts because they don't know how to dress outside of pastor gear, you know? And they have this weird walk and this weird wavy hair and just whole way of presenting themselves. Or the other idea sometimes that is pastors is that they're full of baloney. Are always trying to get the pastor's discount and trying to look out for themselves in kind of a weird holy way. And those two things, both ends of that kind of weirds me out. Anyway, but I like being a pastor. I like being called that. But, you know, thinking about if I were to give myself a different title that would sound cool and hip and trendy and all that kind of stuff, what would it be? And I thought, you know, maybe I could call myself the creative heart communicator. Or the director of leadership and vision, you know, stuff like that, just to sound really like, you know, my position, you know, is cool. But, you know, God has called it pastor, and I'm cool with that. Or elder is another name in the Bible that refers to leadership in the church. But I got to thinking about this with you, and here's what I want you to do. We're going to do some things this morning with preferably a pen and a piece of paper. So if you have like a worship folder or just a piece of paper and something to write with, I'd like you to grab that and pull it out because I'm going to ask you to put some things on the paper here in just a minute. All right, so go ahead and grab that. And the first thing I would like you to think about is think about what you do. A lot of you here are students, or we have moms that are stay-at-home moms, and we have some of you, a lot of people have jobs where you work and do things. But the first thing I'd like you to do is I'd like you to think about your job, your role, and see if you can come up with a catchy title that would define what you do with a cool name. Can you come up with a really cool, trendy, catchy title that defines what you do? Think about that. Write it down. You got about 30 seconds to think about it and write something down. All right, ready, go. Anybody come up with something good? Everybody's like, no, we're not creative. I can't think. Or somebody's got something weird, like, I am not speaking up. What you got back there?
Swami of creativity.
There you go. That's good. Swami of creativity. That'll work on a resume. That'll look good. Anybody else come up with something cool? All right. Seeing that everybody feels awkward at this moment, we'll move on. All right. So you came up with it. Hopefully you came up with something. A lot of you are just like, teacher, electrician. Okay, that's cool. Second thing I want you to write down is this. I want you to write down the names of three people you work with that are either influenced by you or have influence over you. Write down the names of three people that you work with or that you associate with in either job or community roles, stuff like that, that you either have influence over or that have influence over you, all right? You got that? Writing them down? All right, next one, this. Three family members who absolutely get on your nerves. That's the easy one. You're like, oh, I know those people. They're the people that you will go to their funerals and cry, but you don't want to go on vacation with them. You know who we're talking about? The people who every time you go to Thanksgiving or Christmas, there is like a life blow up and you're like, okay, wow. I love you from a distance. That's a good thing. All right, so you write down the names of three people that family members who absolutely get on your nerves. Only three. Keep it short, all right? Number four, a person in the community that you tend to cross paths with a lot randomly. Just seems like when you're hanging out, doing life, going to the coffee shop, whatever it is you're doing, you just seem to cross that person's path and you just see them a lot. Maybe, you go up to the school and help out, or maybe you were like in your job. It's just somebody who just seems to come in but somebody that you cross paths and it just seems like it's random all the time, but you just seem to see them a lot. Write down that a person's name who describes that. All right, then number four or number five, write down the names of three neighbors. And if you don't know your neighbors' names, write down their addresses. You're like, all right, 857, 853, 851, come up with something. But think of three neighbors that you either know their names or you at least kind of know the house. You're like, yeah, the people in that house, or the blue house on the corner or whatever. Write down the names or thoughts of three different neighbors that you come into contact with. All right, so we've started this morning, kind of getting the ball rolling, getting you thinking, because the challenges we're looking in the book of Nehemiah is this today. We want to challenge you to think about the fact that there is nothing random in your life, that really, literally, in a very real way, God orchestrates the events of our lives, and that he calls us to live on mission with him. If you are a follower of Jesus, this is what God has done in your life. He has stepped into your life, you have found Christ, you've looked to the cross and trusted Jesus and given him your life, and he is working from the inside out in your life to change you and to give you his passions, to make you more like Jesus, to transform you. But as he does that, as he shapes you and forms you, he also begins to transform the way you think about the world in which you live, and you begin to see that God is at work, that God is on mission, that God is always up to something, accomplishing his purpose, working his plan, that while sometimes we feel like, all right, God's not there, that God hasn't done anything, we begin to see and understand that God is at work and that he literally does, in a sovereign way, orchestrate the events of our lives, and that there is nothing random. And so if that's true, what will take place is that I'll begin to see the position that I have and the relationships that I have differently. I will begin to see that there is nothing in life that is random. That everything that God has done, he's put me in these relationships at this place, at this time, for such a time as this. And what happens in the story of Nehemiah today is that after Nehemiah's been praying for a while, he begins to see his mission, his call, his sense of purpose, his sense of design differently, but he realizes that what needs to happen in his life is he needs to leverage his position and his relationships for God's kingdom. That he is in the place he is in because God has orchestrated the events of his life so that at the moment where it comes to a head, and God opens the doors, he knows that he's not there just because he is this guy, this situation, this job. Now, he's got a really crazy job. We're going to find out in just a minute. In fact, if you have a Bible, go ahead and grab it. We'll be in Nehemiah chapter 1, the last verse of chapter 1, and then the first 8 verses of chapter 2. We're going to find out in just a minute that Nehemiah is a cupbearer, which is a weird role for a job. It doesn't sound cool, doesn't sound trendy. Nehemiah, it doesn't sound like he sat around and came up with a hip, cool name for his job, but it's kind of an interesting job. So if you have a Bible, turn to Nehemiah chapter 1. If you don't, into your rows, we have Bibles for you. We'd love for you to pass those out. Everybody grab a Bible and read along with us. We'll be on page 343 in that Bible, and we will be reading this story, and just kind of as a quick background of where we're at, Nehemiah is an Old Testament story. It's a narrative, a story of how God interacts with his people, and kind of the heart of the story is that God is building a city within a city, that basically God's people living in Jerusalem are in a place where their walls have been knocked down for 140 years. They are not safe. They do not have a comfortable place to raise their families. They do not have a safe and comfortable place to worship, to find God, to interact with him, and they're struggling. And about 1,600 miles away in the capital of the Persian Empire, there's this guy named Nehemiah who has a heart for the city of his ancestors. He's never actually lived here, but it is the town that his ancestors and his spiritual heritage is from. And he gets a report from his brother and some other people that are his friends that the city is just a wreck, that it's in rubble, it's in shambles. We've kind of set up our stage to create the feel of just everything being knocked down. As we've watched the news the last 2 weeks of Haiti, we can feel the impact of news of a place that is in shambles, where people are not safe, that the walls have been knocked down, that people are having a hard time surviving. And Nehemiah feels the weight of this. He feels this news, he feels the weight of it, and Nehemiah begins to pray. You read his prayer just a minute ago. It was a prayer from our heart this morning. But that prayer is a reflection of something that went on for 4 months. For 4 months, Nehemiah has been fasting. He has been praying. He has been seeking God and saying, God, what are you up to? Involve me. I will go. I will be what you've called me to do. I will make a difference. And I will live for your kingdom, for your glory. Help me figure out what that looks like in my life. And as he prays, he begins to pray for the king. Now, we're going to find out in just a minute why he's praying specifically for the king. He's praying for a man named Artaxerxes. He is a world emperor. He is one of the, you know, as you read your history books, he is one of the big names on the charts, okay, on the timelines. He is a big deal. He is up there with guys like the pharaohs in Egypt. He is up there with people like Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. He is up there with people like the emperors, the rulers, the Caesars in Rome, like Julius Caesar. He is a guy that is on this level of leadership. He's not just like a regional kind of, I rule a few people. The Persian Empire had conquered pretty much the known world except Greece. They never did conquer Greece, but the rest of the known world, they had pretty much conquered. And Artaxerxes is the dude who runs this army, these people, this country. And Nehemiah begins to pray for him in chapter 1, verse 11. And so go ahead, pick it up there, and I'll show you where he prays for him, and then I'm going to show you what Nehemiah is all about, what he does, what his title is. Verse 11 says, O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name, and give success to your servant today. In other words, God, show up in power in my life because I know you're forming a plan in me. And grant him mercy in the sight of this man. And that this man is Artaxerxes, this world emperor. And then he says, now I was cupbearer to the king. Now let's be honest, guys, just for real, if you're a dude in this room, you do not want the title cupbearer on your resume, right? I mean, you're like, if that was like my title, you would come up with a different name. But here's what's crazy, is he says he is the cupbearer to the king. Well, that sounds like this weird, wimpy, like you work in a locker room guy, okay? It actually is the ultimate man job, okay? Ultimate man job. Because basically when he says, Nehemiah says he is the cupbearer to the king, it is kind of like being the cross between these two people. First of all, the cross between being Sam Malone. All right, you're like, yeah, bartender, okay? This is part of his job is that he is kind of a cross between Sam Malone and Jack Bauer. That's what being a cupbearer. Now, it doesn't sound cool. I'm telling you, somebody should have said, all right, we got to come up with another name for this. But let me explain what a cupbearer does. A cupbearer has risen to a point where he is the closest personal confidant, the closest slave. It's a slave position, but he has risen to the point where his role is that he is right next to the king, and he has two jobs. He is to care for the vineyards and select the wine for the king. So when the king throws a party or when the king has dinner, it's his job to tend bar, to choose the drinks, to choose the wine for the event, okay? And the second thing that he does, though, the reason that is so important is because in the ancient world, you didn't have snipers. You didn't, it would be impossible to get close to a world leader. But everybody was out for their head. Everybody was out to get them, to pull them off their throne, to depose them of power, to take them out. And so the way that people would do that would be to poison their food and specifically to slip poison in their wine. And the cupbearer's job was to make sure that that never happened. He protected the wine, but he also would always test it up, right up front. He literally was there to take a bullet for the king. A few years ago, we went to Washington, D.C. And when we went to D.C., we got a chance to go tour the White House. And if you've ever had the opportunity to tour the White House, it's a cool thing, but they will not let you take anything in the White House. Literally, all you can carry in a White House is your cell phone, which they check seriously, your keys. That's it. You can't carry a purse. You can't carry a bag, especially like a diaper bag. You can't show up with a stroller. If you show up with any of that stuff, they send you out. It's not like they have a place where you can leave it. You can't even take it to the front gate. And so when we went to D.C., my son Josiah was about almost 2 years old, I guess. We went there as a family, he's still in diapers. And so we had to come up with this really elaborate plan for how we're going to take the stroller from our hotel, which is, about 20 miles outside of Washington. We couldn't not bring our stroller and not bring the diaper bag because we're going to be in town all day. How are we going to take the stroller and our diaper bag and leave it in our congressman's office? Our congressman here, Jim Talent actually told us we could leave our stuff in his office, and then get from there to the White House, do our tour, get to another place we had to go, and make all this happen with no diapers, no stuff like that. And so we went all the way to the White House. We got there. We started the White House tour, and my son Josiah's claim to fame is that he did fill his diaper in the White House. People are walking around looking at pictures of Eleanor Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy going, man, this place, you would think it smells better than it does. And we had to go through the whole tour. Nothing we could do. We had no diapers. I mean, we had to get all the way back across town just to fix this problem. And so we were touring the White House, checking everything out. But one of the crazy things we were walking through there is we discovered that in the White House, there are two types of Secret Service guys in the White House. And you have the typical guys who are, standing in suits doing, this stuff, nonstop. And you see those guys kind of periodically in room to room, and they're directing traffic. They're moving people from place to place. But there was another set of people in the White House that we were like, wow, those guys are amazing. These guys are dressed in all black, like a parachute type pant, black shirt, black armored vest, everything's black, black hat. These guys had a gun strapped to every possible point of their body. It did not matter how they were twisted at the time, they could have a gun out and drop you like that. Knives sticking here and here, and these big old machines. I mean, these guys had 30 weapons on them. And you're you pass the first one, when you get right through the first door, and there's this dude. And you're the guys in the suits, I mean, they're kind of weird, but these dudes in the black, there is no way I am messing with anything in the White House. In fact, we were a little nervous that they were going to throw us out, and they're going to stick this guy, Jack Bauer dude, on us and throw us out because we stunk the place up. And so you're just walking through, and it's intimidating to see these guys. They are dudes who protect the place, but more than that, they're there to protect the guy. The man that lives in that house and his family, and to make sure nobody even thinks about. Well, this is Nehemiah. This is his role. He is to protect the king. He's the king's bartender / secret service, the head of the secret service in the country. And the reason he got to this position was because of trust and his leadership and all that kind of stuff. But he was in a place of a lot of influence. He was in a job that was really cool. It had a lot of prestige. And like I said, combination bartender slash secret service. I mean, most dudes are like, how do I get that job, you know? And here is Nehemiah in this role. And so let's pick the story up there. In chapter 2, verse 1, it says, in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, this is in the spring, probably the month of April, when wine was before him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. So in other words, what he's communicating here is there was a party, there was a festival, something's going on, and now his job as bartender is coming in. He has taken the wine, he has served it to the king, he is caring for his job, and he's doing it well. I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. Now, like I've already told you, for 4 months he has been fasting, praying, mourning. He has experienced the brokenness of his hometown. He knows that God is at work. He knows that God wants to form his people, to give the people of God a safe place to worship and to celebrate and to know their God. And it's left him broken, but he has been careful not to let that show in the presence of the king. But on this night, it gets a little bit different. He says, and the king said to me, why is your face sad, seeing that you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart. And then I was very much afraid. He kind of lets his guard down. And in this party, when everybody else is partying, he's a little bit somber. He's a little bit sad. He's a little bit despondent. And it says, I became very much afraid. And I think there's a couple ideas that are possible here, and probably it's a mix of all of them. First of all, the king inquires, and he's sad because when the king's throwing a party and you work for the king, you need to put on a happy face and be happy, and because you don't want to drag the king's party down. But on top of that, the king hosting a party, a secret service guy who's down in the mouth may make the king a little bit suspicious that, wait a minute, is your change of attitude because something is going on, because somebody has hired you out. And, you know, so he gets a little bit afraid because, well, not a little bit afraid. The text actually says, I was much afraid. I was totally freaked out. I was at this moment where the lines of my prayer and the events of life had crossed. But it came up because he kind of let his guard down and he let his face show. And the king has a little bit of nervousness and says, what's bothering you, dude? Your job, you shouldn't have a sad face. There's something going on. But I think the third thing that's going on here is that Nehemiah has been praying for 4 months, and he knows that God has presented him an opportunity to have the ear of the king for a moment, and it may be his time to act. And see, this is what happens as a follower of Jesus, and especially as you're a leader. Anytime you begin to live for the purpose of God and the glory of God and be called to live for something that is just greater than being whatever your job and your, just, you know, when you begin to see that life is not random, that God is orchestrating the events of your life, there are going to be major points as you lead, as you speak, as you live, where you're going to have massive fear. And I love how the text here is just kind of blatantly honest about the struggle. Nehemiah is afraid. It reminds me of a commander of a ship in back in the ancient days where ship captains would have to guard themselves against pirates in the Caribbean. And this ship captain was captaining this ship. And one of his stewards came and said, Captain, there are 3 ships coming at us. What should we do? And he said, bring me my red shirt. And the battle took place and they were victorious. And the next day the guy came and said, Captain, there are 5 ships coming at us. He said, bring me my red shirt. And so he got the red shirt on and they were victorious. They were able to defend themselves. And the steward looked at him and said, man, every time I come with this news that there is a ship coming, you tell me to bring you your red shirt. Why? And he said, because I am the leader of this vessel and the men will fight valiantly as long as I can lead them. And I realize that if I get wounded, if I get injured, if I get hurt and the men turn around and see me, they're going to be despondent. They're going to struggle. They're going to get afraid. But as long as I can grab something and hold myself up, even if I'm injured, if I have my red shirt, nobody will know and I will lead these men. And the steward was like, wow, that's amazing. The next morning he wakes up, he comes, Captain, there are 30 ships coming at us. And the captain says, bring me my brown pants. There are points where this is life. And what happens is for a lot of people who are following Jesus, they feel the sense of the call, the purpose of God in their lives. But these moments where they just can't get past, I'm afraid of what will happen. For Nehemiah, the outcome of this next conversation could mean the loss of his prestige, the loss of the trust of the king, the loss of his position, maybe the loss of his life. And he was afraid. And we all, I mean, as you've wrestled with what it means to be a follower of Jesus, we've all come to points where we have been afraid. But here's what happens, is God forms his people. Because the whole theme of this book, Nehemiah, is how does God build his people? This city, this idea of a city within a city, a people who've been called by God to live for his glory in the midst of a culture around them that doesn't really know God. As God is going to shape and form these people, what has to take place is that God is going to raise up people who understand the purpose and the mission of God, and they will begin living God's purpose in their life, in the culture, in the community, which means there are going to be times of fear. And what happens so often in church, and I can tell you from our experience, is so often as you lead a people, as you think about church life, as you figure out what it means to be the people of God, it is so easy to go out and draw people who are natural leaders, people who are very good at casting vision, articulating dream, have big ideas. We'll pick up the sword and say, run with me. And there is a sense in which those type of people who have gifts, talents, ability, charisma, there's a tendency to grab those people and put them on stage or give them a lot of leadership and just kind of put them in charge of stuff. And what we've learned here is that leadership needs to be way more than just people who seem to be gifted leaders. And in the story of our church, we've actually had two situations. And I won't go into detail about those situations, but we actually have had two situations where people who had a high level of skill, high levels of ability, and really were leadership type people in terms of their makeup, their who they were. But they were not the type of people who would step over these fear issues and would really say, listen, God is on mission, I'm going to join him. And we had this tendency, because they were gifted in leadership, to move them to points where we were kind of putting them in leadership. And what God did is God graciously protected us from making big mistakes with those people. And I say this because of this. Here's what's going on at Genesis right now. We're at the season of a church where we've been doing life, we've been doing faith, we've been doing church for almost 3.5 years. If you were here last year, you heard us tell the story. And there's a sense in which, in a lot of ways, we've kind of become the church that we began to pray about being, to dream about, that we felt like God was calling us to be. And we see a lot of these values and ideas happening here. But we are kind of at a place where we are really starting to cry out and depend on God to raise up people who will be leaders, who will take God's mission and live it out here, live it out in our communities, live it out and really live for the greater glory of God. And as we do that together, that God will spread the ministry, the ability that we have to serve and be missionaries in our community and all that kind of stuff, that we need God. We're praying that God will raise up leaders. But we don't necessarily just want people who are gifted in leadership. We want people who are like Nehemiah, who come from the bottom up and just kind of start as just people who are figuring out what it looks like to live for God in the position they are in. But they do it for the glory of God in such a way that God is just kind of puts them in great places and gives them a great heart. And the outcome is that they will begin to leverage their relationships and their leadership and that kind of stuff for the kingdom. That's the type of leadership that God is wanting to raise, that God does raise, and that Nehemiah has become. And so he's afraid, but keep reading with me. In chapter 2, verse 3 there, it says, "So I said to the king," after he said I was very much a king, "I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed with fire? And the king said to me, what are you requesting? So I prayed to the God of heaven and I said to the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. And the king said to me, with the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone and when will you return? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. So here's what happens. The king looks at him and says, you look sad. Nehemiah's afraid, but Nehemiah at this point in time makes a decision. I am stepping over this. I am seeing this as an opportunity. God has called me to something that is greater than just my comfort here in Persia. And so he lays it online. He says, why would I not be sad when the place where my ancestors were, the town of my fathers, the place of my spiritual heritage lies in ruins? Now, the reason this is so gutsy here is because in Ezra chapter 4, there is the story of other people trying to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and to take care of it. And this very king has already issued a foreign policy decision that said Jerusalem will not be rebuilt. That we fear if Jerusalem rebuilds, that they'll try to create a stronghold, and we actually need this plot of ground in the Middle East as a buffer between us and Egypt. We need to be able to advance our armies to Egypt without a lot of trouble. And so we need this area, and if Jerusalem rebuilds, maybe they will try to set up a king and try to become another group that fights us. I'm not going to do this. And the king has already made a decision, issued a decree, no building, rebuilding in Jerusalem. And really what's going on is you have this guy who's the bartender for the king, looking the king in the face and going, dude, I really don't like your foreign policy. I think you ought to change it. And oh, by the way, send me as the ambassador for this change. I mean, imagine, you know, some guy sweeping the White House, walking into President Obama and going, hey, man, what you're doing in Afghanistan, not a good idea. I got some ideas. Let me help you fix this. And oh, by the way, I know that I just like sweep your office, but send me. I'll be the guy that goes. That's what's happening here. And Nehemiah shares this idea, says, listen, I am despondent because of this. Send me. Let me be a part of this. Now, I know for us, we look at that and we're like, but that's not me. That's not where my life is. But I want to explain to you what's going on in terms of God being on mission, because this is all about a God who is always at work to accomplish his purposes. And what's happened is over the last 140 years, the city has been in ruins, but God has been promising the sending of a Messiah, a promised one. Jesus is going to come. And Jesus is going to die for the sins of all people. He is going to be the savior of the world. He's going to be the one who expresses and demonstrates the love of God. But the people that God is going to send Jesus through will be the Jewish people. And God is at work preparing his nation to have a group of people that will be ready for the coming of the Messiah. And he has called Nehemiah to be a part of that. So here we are today, and we live in Eureka. We hang out, we work here, we live here. Some of you live in outskirts and Baldwin and other places, but as a church, we're kind of planted here, and we live in this great town. It's kind of this, you know, this crash between small town and suburbia, and you know, we can hop in our cars and be in St. Louis in 5 minutes, and we love the people of this town. We love the idea of living here. The schools are awesome and all this kind of stuff, and we get very comfortable living in this town, but I want to let you know that God is at work, that God is still on mission, but his mission now is to raise a people, churches, people who love Jesus, who are being transformed by his grace, being transformed by his power, experiencing the power of the Spirit in their lives, the Holy Spirit in their lives. And as they experience that, they live as a city within a city, but they begin to live influence in the culture around them. So many churches, what they do is they gather people who are Christians and they create holy huddles where everybody's just comfortable in their little box, and they all have titles and positions and roles in the church, but those roles never cause them to step over their fears and step outside of their comfort zone and get into a place where they live for the influence of God's kingdom in a greater way. And Nehemiah is being called to leave the coolest job for a dude on the planet, to go to a city that's in shambles and try to lead a people that don't even want him there. And he says to the king, send me. I'm going to be the guy that goes, I think you ought to change your foreign policy. Let me go back to Jerusalem. Let me rebuild it. Let me change this place. Will you do that? What's really interesting, it says that, you know, he asks about finding favor in the eyes of the king. He has developed a relationship so the king's comfortable with this. And in verse six says, how long will you be gone? It sounds like, you know, is this like a 2-week break? Are you going like on a mission trip down there for a couple weeks, build a little bit and come back? And he says, I gave him a time. The time isn't given here, but basically he's asking for a 12-year vacation. Because later in the book of Nehemiah, it tells us it's 12 years before he comes back, that the time that he is asked off is 12 years to go do this task. And it says, verse six, it says, so it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And so you think, okay, here it is. This is a good place to stop and go, thanks be to Jesus, God's gonna let me go. But Nehemiah does not stop here. He invites the king to be in God's mission. Look at it, verse 7. And so I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me to the governors of the province beyond the river that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. So the first thing Nehemiah says is, hey, king, I want you to be involved in this. Will you write me a letter so that as I'm coming with my what I'm supposed to do, people know who I am. They know that I'm Jewish. They know my background and heritage. As I go the 1,600 mile route, there's going to be people who stop me who try to keep this from happening. But if I have a letter from you that says, this isn't just my idea. This is what the king wants. Artaxerxes wants this. They will not mess with me. They will leave me alone. So he says, give me that letter. Verse 8, he says, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and the wall of the city for the house that I will occupy. And the king granted me what I asked for the good hand of my God was upon me. In other words, he said, all right, send me a letter that is like with your signature and your seal that says, don't mess with this guy. He's on my, you know, this is something I'm sending him to do. Don't mess with Nehemiah. And he also says, and I want your Lowe's credit card. I want you to send me to the keeper of your forest, the guys who are cutting all your wood. I want you to send the lumber. I want you to fund this. I don't want you to just send me, king. I want you to be the one who sends the materials and makes it happen. And it says that it happened, and here's the key phrase. For the hand of the Lord was with me. In other words, God was already at work building his people for his purpose and his mission. And kind of the question is for us today is this, if God really began to shape us and form us and build a people, and we knew that the hand of the Lord was with us, and that he had placed us here for such a time as this, how would that change us? Back to your creative job and your neighbors and your family members. See, we tend to see all the things in our lives is just random sets of events that just happen. That I just so happen to be a teacher, a pastor, a electrician, a person who works at this company. It just kind of happened that I met my husband, I met my wife, and we ended up in Eureka. It just so happened that, you know, my neighbors live here, and, I run into this person, and I work with these people. And it just kind of, we tend to see all of our lives as a random set of events. And what the story of Nehemiah should help us be challenged with is that instead of seeing our lives as random sets of events and random sets of relationships, that God literally has orchestrated our lives so that we are living in the right street, the right house, with the right job, among the right people for such a time as this. And he has called us because God is already on mission. God is already saving people. There is a phrase that's really interesting in the book of Acts. It's Paul, this guy named Paul, who is doing these missionary journeys. He's going from town to town to town, telling people about Jesus. And in one of the stories about one of the towns, he's praying about it, and God sends him to a certain city, and this is the way God puts it. He says, for I already have a bunch of people in that town. Now, nobody in that town was a Christian yet. But see, what God's communicating to Paul is you don't go alone. I'm already at work and I am going to change the lives of people. You just need to go and be faithful. Nehemiah, he's been praying for 4 months and he realizes God has called me. This is the mission God has. He is at work. He is accomplishing his purpose, but he's called me to be a part of it. I could stay as the cupbearer of the king, live my days out, retire, have a lot of really good wine and a lot of really good conversation in a place of high prestige and high influence. I could sit right next to the king for the rest of my life. But God has made me a cupbearer for such a time as this. And here's the big deal, the big point, the big picture. That is how God builds his people. When all of a sudden he begins to shape and form our lives and raises up people who begin to say, My job is not random. I live in this culture, but I live for a greater purpose than just whatever it is that you do. That God is on mission, and this is my place in the mission. Now, how does that look? Well, what I want to challenge you is the way we shape that out is two simple little words, and it's the words invest and invite. I want to encourage you that just kind of, I want to apply this really simply and say, what does this look like for you and for me in our daily lives with the relationships we have and that kind of stuff? And it means that we need to be people who invest in the lives of people and live out God's mission. And then we need to invite them to think and know God on a deeper level than they do and to find Jesus. Now, I know when I first say that, everybody's like, oh, okay, so this is what this is. Ultimately, you're telling me I need to go knock door to door and invite all my neighbors to church and they, you know, I need to take them a gospel tract or, you know, just a little brochure. And you're like checking out right now going, I can't do that, Mike. I cannot, I get the fear thing, but let me be honest with you. I can't step over that. It's not really what I'm asking you to do. I'm asking you to begin to figure out what the mission of God looks like in your life and figure out how to invest in people's lives and then find ways to just have conversations with them when God opens doors and creates opportunities, okay? So first of all, invest. And let me show you what I'm talking about in Nehemiah's life. You do not become the cupbearer to the king by being a disgruntled, angry, frustrated employee who is always backstabbing and stealing paper clips and doing all this kind of stuff, right? Something happened as Nehemiah lived out his faith on a daily basis before he ever heard the news about Jerusalem. Something happened as a Jewish young man, as he lived out his faith, his values, his passion for the one and only God and the situation that he was in, that he fast-tracked to a position where now he is right next to the king. And see, the first thing I just want to tell you is that whatever your position is, Sometimes we feel like, well, if I could only go and do this, or if I could only get this job, or if I could only move in this community, or if I could only, you know, have this boss, or if I could only do these things, that God could really use me if I did that. And I just want to tell you that God has you where he wants you right now. That doesn't mean there won't be something different along the way, but live that. Live what it means to be a follower of Jesus with one God, Jesus Christ, at the center of your life in the position you're in. And let God work things out, but you invest yourself in what you're already doing and do it well. This is why Paul says, whatever you do, whether you in work or in deed, you do it all to the glory of God. Because in my job, in my work, in my role as a mom, as my role as a dad, in my role as a person who is a parent over and helps at school, whatever it is, I do it in such a way that I don't do it with a lot of grumbling, complaining, that I'm positive, and that I just live out somebody who really has Christ at the center of my life. But then God gives us a pool of influence, a pool of relationships in the midst of that. And what we see here is that Nehemiah comes to a point where he says, this relationship I have with the king is not random. I'm here for something bigger than just my comfort and my sense of well-being. I'm here for something bigger than being the Jack Bauer of my culture. I am here so that God will open an opportunity. And he begins to invest in the king. He invests in that relationship. He is praying for him. He is developing a good relationship with him. He's just kind of being somebody who is faithful in what he's already been called to do. And part of this is that I just want to let you know that we have to come to the point where, see, this sounds like I'm saying make all your friends a project. No, it's actually just the opposite. We just need to live and invest in people's lives just because that's what Jesus does for us. With no ulterior motives and no, hear me, I'm not telling you to go make all your friends a project. All right, I gave you this list of people. Now, pick three people and make that your project for the next 3 weeks that you like do this and this and this. But I do think that we need to start being intentional about living our lives before those people, that we just don't keep it at a distance. We begin to find ways to be intentional about living our lives before those people in just loving, creative ways. So for example, a great idea that I think everybody can be thinking about is we need to have more meals with people who are not in our little close, tight-knit group. Now, I'm preaching to me now, okay? I'm talking to me. I need to have more meals with people who are not followers of Jesus, but they're in my peer group and group of people in my neighborhood and that kind of stuff. I need to intentionally invest myself in things like, for me, I'm on the board of the local sports association. I love that. Part of the reason I do that is to get me outside the bubble that is Genesis Church, okay? But I'm not on that board so that everybody there is a project for me to try to get to come to Genesis. It's just a place where I can invest in relationships, rub elbows with people, get to know them, and try to, fail though I know I do, try to live out what it means to just be a follower of Jesus in those relationships. Some of you are coaches of kids' sports teams. Some of you lead other stuff where there's kids in the neighborhood. This is the kind of, and you just intentionally invest yourselves into the lives of people. I never watched anybody who was better in this than my dad, who for 30 years coached at Maplewood High School. He was this guy, he was a white coach with all African-American students. I mean, he had like, you know, in 20-something years of coaching the varsity basketball team, he had like 6 white guys on his team in all those years. But he just constantly was loving those guys, picking them up, caring for them, you know, having them over for breakfast, just living his faith before them as he, you know, yelled at them in a gym and made them run separators. But his influence over them was so good, and he invested in their lives. He saw it more than, well, I'm just the coach. My goal is to win basketball games. He realized that God had placed him there for such a time as this, and over the years saw several of his students come to Jesus, investing in relationships. And then the second thing is then you start inviting. You start finding opportunities and open doors to talk about your relationship with Christ, to share your story, just to have conversations. Yes, if God opens the door, you invite them to church. I think that's a good thing. It's a good strategy to say, hey, man, I'm going hanging out at this weird church. They play really loud music. They show a lot of video. And it's really designed for people to be comfortable when they show up. Come with me. And inviting people to church. But that's not really the heart, the center. That's kind of the outcome of other things. As you begin to just find opportunities to have conversations, as God gives the open doors. And what's going to happen is those open doors are going to come and you're going to feel it and you're going to get afraid. Follow Nehemiah's model. Pray. Pray for those people, and then in those moments, just have prayers. God, help me. Help me figure this out. You know, Nehemiah chapter 1 is 4 months of prayer. In Nehemiah chapter 2, it says he became afraid and the king said something else to him and says, so I prayed. I don't think Nehemiah was talking to the king and said, all right, king, hold on just a minute. Dear God, I'm about to tell this guy something, and I need your help. You know what he's saying is I was talking to him, and his words were coming in my mouth in conversation. I was listening. I was having 2 conversations at once. Now, we as guys, we don't multitask well, which means you know that if he started having this deep conversation with God, he forgot everything the king said. That's not good. So his prayer was like this. Oh, God, help me. But he prayed. Involve God in this and realize that the hand of the Lord is with you. Begin to find ways to invest and invite and just see you're a student, you're a teacher, you're a business owner, you're a person, I mean, whatever it is, whatever your creative job, and you live at this street, you live in these relationships, you have these whacked out family members. None of them are random. I'm gonna close this morning telling you a quick story. We went to this place, this Christmas with a group of our teenagers. We took them down to go to this conference down in Branson. And some really good bands, really good speakers, guys shared. And they had this one guy, his name was Ergen Kaner, who shared his testimony. And the brief story of his testimony goes like this. He grew up in a Middle Eastern country as a Muslim, and his dad moved the family to America when he was a young child, moved the family to America to be a missionary, a Muslim missionary, doing what I'm saying to do, but doing it for the Muslim religion. Literally, he was going to buy a business, and then from that business, use it as a base operation to influence people to become Muslims, okay? That's what his dad came here to do. And this kid started hanging out in school. There's no Muslim schools in America, so he had to go to public schools. He was hanging out in public schools. And when he got to high school, starting as a freshman, he had a couple friends, but very specifically, this one guy, one Christian guy, who said, I am at this high school for something greater than just to get A's, B's, and flirt with girls, and start growing body hair. And he said, this kid literally felt like his purpose was to live the kingdom, to influence, to invest in these people's lives, but specifically in Kaner's life, and to invite him. And he began to invest in his life. He began to just love him and show Christianity. And Kaner's idea of Christianity was that they're all whacked out weirdos who are mean-spirited and hate us. But this kid just kept loving on him, just kept, you know, inviting him to stuff. He'd invite him to church, but he'd also invite him to go get milkshakes and that kind of stuff. And for 4 years, he kept just investing in this relationship with this Muslim guy. And instead of being afraid of him, instead of getting freaked out at his accent, instead of having a hard situation where he just wanted to run, this kid just kept at it. Finally, senior year, he kept inviting, and Kaner looked at him and said, "Dude, I'm tired of you inviting me to this stuff. Here's the deal. If you will go to my mosque on Friday night, I will go to church with you on Sunday morning." And as he tells the story, Kaner said, basically, "I knew that if I threw that out, Christians are wimps. They'll never do it." But this guy called his bluff. He said he showed up. I was sitting in my mosque Friday night, and this guy showed up with a big old, to a mosque with a big old fat Bible and a Jesus Saves shirt. And he says he called my bluff. And so on Sunday, I had to keep my end of deal. He went to this little church, heard the message of Jesus. All he'd ever heard about Jesus was that Jesus was this whacked out infidel and that followers of Jesus need to be stopped. And he heard the message that Jesus loves him, the message of grace. And he was compelled. He came back the next week. 3 weeks later, he gave his life to Jesus. And here's what's going on now as a result of it. Erwin Kaner became a follower of Jesus. His two brothers became followers of Jesus. Erwin Kaner is the dean of Liberty University, a Christian school, and he preaches to thousands. His two brothers are both pastors or seminary professors who are sharing the gospel all over the world, and it's all because of one high school student who said, "I'm going to be Nehemiah. I'm not here just because this is high school. I'm here because God is on mission. He's called me to join him." And the challenge of Nehemiah, God builds his people when he starts working in our lives and calling us to leadership, not by saying, "I'm going to be the guy who's in charge of so-and-so committee at a church." I'm the guy who's on mission. Now, here's the deal. Some of you hear this is totally like weird and new to you, and I just want to tell you that the starting place for you is that we need to invite you to Jesus to begin with. That you need to come to a point where you just say, "I trust Jesus, I give my life to him," and you become a Christian. I just want to encourage you, if you are here and you're just kind of seeking and looking after God and trying to figure this thing out, that Jesus is the answer, that he will change your life. He loves you. He died on the cross. He rose again 3 days later for you, and he offers you forgiveness, hope. And if you will repent, which means turn from your sin and confess him, trust him as your Lord and Savior, he will change you. He will save you. And you can do that right now as we're going to sing in the next few minutes. You can just stop right where you are and pray and say, "Jesus, I want to become a Christian. Come into my life and save me." For the rest of us, the challenge is pretty clear. Do we see our lives as random, or do we see them as part of the purpose of God? Figure out what that looks like for you this week. I'm going to pray. The band's going to come out. We're going to sing to Jesus and worship him because he is the center of what we're hoping for. Lord, we love you. We praise you. We just ask that you'll call us to yourself and continue to work in our lives. And Lord, help us to realize that this is how you build your people. You change us by calling us on mission with you. Lord, you've placed us, Genesis, for such a time as this in this community. Help us to see that. We love you today. We worship you. In your name I pray. Amen.